talk given on Monday, May 12, 1986, at St. James's Church, Piccadilly, London, by Feroz Mehta on Whither Goes Man. Let us consider together this subject, Whither Goes Man, a very pressing subject today. The word consider is derived from a finite form of the Old English canon, which means to regard studiously or to examine carefully, and the Latin sidus, which means a star or a constellation. Now, a star is a self-shining light. Hence, to consider means to look intently at the self-shining light. For us, this self-shining light concerning God and man and his fulfillment is the secret light that shines constantly within us in the darkness of our own existential being, the psychophysical organism known in the world by our names. Most of us are blind to this light, which is transcendence itself embodied in us. Our paramount personal task in life is to discover how and why we do shut out the light. For when we see for ourselves the truth about ourselves, the darkness is dispelled. Psychologically, the correct diagnosis, if made by ourselves, is itself the cure. Meister Eckhart, in one of his Ascension Day sermons, entitled Hindrances, said, with special reference to Jesus Christ, "For man is truly God, and God is truly man." I would add to that unequivocally, so it is potentially for every person, for it is a fact that there have been perfected holy ones through the centuries. In a sermon preached on Innocence Day, Meister Eckhart declared, "The godly man talks readily only about God." From Meister Eckhart's statements, talking about man seems somewhat akin to talking about God. It is wise for me to say very little about God. God must be experienced. I have looked into the many God conceptions presented in the scriptural writings of the world. Most of them are projections out of man's brain of a glorified, apotheosized man. As such, they are inadequate. God does not answer to man's limited descriptions. But all the affirmations made by the holy ones during the last few thousand years of conversing with God and of union with God, or of being touched by transcendence, are amongst the truest, noblest, and most healing affirmations made since man first evolved into an upright walking human some 3.5 million years ago. William Sharp wrote these lines: "I dreamed of Orchil, the dim goddess who is under the brown earth, in a vast cavern where she weaves at two looms. With one hand, she weaves life upward through the grass. With the other, she weaves death downward through the mould. And the sound of the weaving is eternity. And the name of it in the green world is time. And through all, Orchil weaves the weft of eternal beauty. Eternal beauty that passeth not, though its soul is change. The voice of the poet, like the voice of the mystic and of the truly religious man, sings of eternity. Equally well could he sing of infinity and of immortality, for these three, infinity, eternity, and immortality, are of the nature of God, the very substance of God, the context in which the creative energy of transcendence acts. William Sharp wrote of weaving life upward through the grass and of weaving death downward through the mould. Instead of life and death, I would rather say birth and death, for life in its transcendent reality is eternal. Our organic life manifests itself between the complementary poles of birth and death. We, as we are at present, are capable of being conscious only in terms of these complementary poles and of the in-between shadow play projected on the screen of matter by eternal life. Thus far only have we evolved, seeing the shadow play and mistaking it for the spirit, experiencing the illusion and believing it to be reality. Long ago in India, they called it Maya. Today, thus. But what of the morrow? And do remember that a billion-year period of time is not even a flash of eternity. The whole of what we mortals call the past, the present, and the future is cradled in eternity, all in simultaneity. That is why God is omniscient, all-seeing, and all-knowing. How can you and I glimpse the morrow? Look intently at what is here. Consider it. Look now. Look within. But look as silently as possible, free of the turmoil of the constantly chattering brain. Look with love. Love not aflame with all desire to gain heaven for oneself, but love at peace. Look intelligently, that is, selflessly, keeping yourself in the state of worldly unknowing, for then God is looking at God through your eyes. Man is fundamentally a religious being, only secondarily, very secondarily, is he a political, social, and economic animal, as per Aristotle, Rousseau, and Marx. What does the word religion mean? Cicero, B.C. 106-43, derived religio from re legere, to gather together. In the Zarathustrian scriptures, it is written that Zarathustra asks God, what are his names? Ahura Mazda mentions 20 names, of which the second is the gatherer, the divine shepherd. The first is Ahammi, I am, or I who am, and the 20th is Ahammi Yat Ahammi, I am that I am. In Exodus 3:14, we have Moses being instructed by Yahweh Elohim to say to the Israelites, Ehye Asher Ehye, I am that I am. The root of the Hebrew word Ehye is the same as the root of Yahweh. But Servius and Lactantius, known as the Christian Cicero of the 3rd century AD, and later still St. Augustine, 354 to 430, the Numidian Bishop of Hippo, in his Retractiones 1:13, derived religio from re ligare. The root league means to bind, and re ligare means to bind back to our origin, to God. This is in line with the Sanskrit root yuj of the Indian word yoga. It means to join together or to restore man to his source. When we first become conscious, however dimly, that there is that which is transcendent to us, our hitherto dormant religious sense begins to stir. If it grows, we feel that we owe obedience and reverence to it. Obedience, derived from ob and audire, means essentially to listen, to give ear to. If this feeling is nurtured with care and love, and intellectual perception intensifies it, we become ready and willing to worship the transcendent, that is, to hold it as supremely worthy. In culmination, we long to realize transcendence, to be in union with it, to be at home in it throughout our life. Those scientists who are inflexibly materialistic tend to scorn this. Nevertheless, there have been, there are, and there will be scientists who are religious. And it may well be that the work of modern scientists will prove to be one of the powerful promoters of the religious vision and of religious living. For me, whatsoever purifies, heals, and perfects a man, relates him rightly and fully to life, enables him to realize the transcendent in clear consciousness, and to live by that realization, is religion. Quite naturally, questions arise. One, how do I realize the transcendent? Two, who will teach me? Three, what is the way? The answers may be somewhat surprising, and I accept full responsibility for what I am going to say. Your own living body, the psychophysical organism, provides the way. Study it carefully. Observe it constantly with an open mind, free of bias and prejudice, preconception and assumption. This living body is a microcosm, a very small cosmos. It reflects the macrocosm, the universe. The Greek word cosmos means order, and universe, from the Latin unus, one, and vertere, to turn, means turned into a unity maintained in order by the operation of divine law. This law is not an imposed compulsion. It is inherent in the very being of the one total reality. Zarathustra called it Asha. The Rig Vedic poet seers called it Ritha. India as a whole called it Karma. This law is not retributive justice. Its function is to heal, to make perfect, holy. So, observe this psychophysical organism constantly, dispassionately. It is your best teacher, and it will teach you what you actually are. When you truly know the ways of your own self, you will find it easy to understand the ways of all men, for each one of us is a variation played by eternal life on the theme of man. You and I are but different versions of each other. Also, you may glimpse, even be in tune with, the ways of God, the ways of an otherwise inscrutable providence. Then you will see the truth of Eckhart's statement, "For man is truly God, and God is truly man." The body, your own psychophysical organism, not only provides the way, but is also your source of instruction and illumination if you pay proper attention to it. Innermost consciousness, which is also the divine consciousness, the universal consciousness of the one total reality, is the traveler on this way. Although universal, it is also particular insofar as the universal inevitably functions in each and every one of us who are unique particulars. As you observe the body, intellect and feeling, the masculine and feminine aspects of mind become conjoined. This conjugation is your first realization of the marriage made in heaven, of love at peace. It gives birth to a spiritual knowledge, the knowledge of your own uniqueness, which is quite different from the overweening conceit of self-approbation. Consider what happens in the procreative process. Each parent produces a gamete, a mature reproductive cell. Whether male or female, its development differs from that of a non-reproductive cell, for it involves the rearrangement, and this is the most important point, the rearrangement of the genetic material inherited by each parent from their parents. The union of the male and female gametes produces a zygote, which becomes the new individual, different from the parents, different from any person that ever was, is now, or will be. He or she is a new creature with new possibilities of mental and spiritual development, dependent on his or her environment and physical development. This is not a transference or carrying over of karma or character from a pre-existent person, and is incompatible with any theory of reincarnation. Each and every living person is unique. There is no one else in the world who is like you, each one of you. Our psychical life largely depends upon the interaction of the highly complex nervous system and the influence of the endocrines and the condition of the body, in addition to all the external stimuli at play. At death, the brain and central nervous system, and with them the whole record of thought and feeling, are obliterated. The psychophysical organism dies completely. The one act which no one can fail to perform completely. It is this body, not merely the physical material, but our whole unique psychophysical organism, different from any and every other such organism, which is the particular identifiable entity to which we refer when we use the word I, and which is any other such identifiable entity when we say you. Always I am vividly conscious of myself, but rather vaguely conscious of you. You and the universe are regarded by me as the not-self, not wholly related to me, not in timeless unity with me. In short, I, like 5 billion others in the world, am isolatively and separatively self-conscious. This, precisely, is my hell-precipitating ignorance, my undeliberate sin, in which and with which I was born, in which every person is born, and hence can fail to fulfill the purposes of his existence, his divine destiny. This dichotomy in consciousness between self and not self is the root source of all the world's evil and sorrow. No wonder then that one of the world's oldest, humane and sensible religious teaching is, love thy neighbor as thyself. Leviticus 19:18. Who, what is my neighbor? The living creature who is very next to me, the inanimate object which is very next to me. This church is my neighbor. You are my neighbor. And God is my nearest neighbor, and yours too, absolutely, because transcendence, the infinite eternal, is unavoidably omnipresent and in timeless conjugation with its created totality. Has that wonderful, sublime, and terrible affirmation, "I and my Father are one," ever pierced your heart, rushed through your blood like a fiery baptismal stream, and transmuted your isolative, separative, God and truth-denying consciousness into holistic consciousness, which, like the consciousness of God, is all-inclusive, rejecting nothing, not even satanic evil, because its transcendent love and wisdom knows that nothing can be cast out of its own created universe, but everything can be transformed, redeemed, and gathered into its everlasting embrace. The whole evolutionary process is inviting and inspiring man towards the realization of holistic consciousness. This is the main answer to the question, whither goes man? It is Orchil weaving life upward through the grass. Way back in the first century AD, St. Paul wrote these words in his first epistle to the Corinthians, 3:16. "Know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you?" And in the second epistle, Corinthians 6:16, he wrote, "For ye are the temple of the living God." In the Skanda and Maitreya Upanishads of India, it is written, "The body is said to be the temple. The eternal life animating it is Shiva alone, the third person of the Holy Trinity. We are the caretakers of the temple. Our duty is to keep it absolutely pure. Then the light of transcendence shines freely through us without being obstructed. Here we have the answer to our first question. How do I realize transcendence? What we have to do is to be perfectly pure in thought, word, and deed, as taught in the Shandilya Upanishad and much earlier by Zarathustra and the Buddha. It is imperative that I should not delude myself, and still more important, that I should not deceive others regarding the realization of transcendence. No one, so long as he is isolatively and separatively self-conscious, can ever realize transcendence. And even when he is free of such limiting and disuniting self-consciousness, it is not he who realizes transcendence. You or I, however purified or saintly, can never affirm, "I have realized transcendence." The very use of the word "I" separates one from transcendence. It is transcendence which realizes its own transcendence in the form of the full-fledged, perfected human through your being, even as it realizes its eternal beauty as the perfect flower and creature, and the breathtaking wonder and marvel of nature's forms and workings. And the variety of all this revelation is inexhaustible. When you and I have done our duty, purified the psyche, kept the temple clean, and divested ourselves of all selfness, then the grace of transcendence enfolds us completely, showering bliss upon us and suffusing our entire being. The physical body itself may be transfigured, as we experience and know here now whilst alive the meaning of immortality. All that we have to do is to stay pure, mindful, and silent. Transcendence does all the rest. In that divine unity in holistic consciousness, every vestige of selfness has given way to selflessness. There is no separate I. There is only transcendence, the unitary whole. I, the little stream, am now inseparably one with the infinite ocean. Thus does God prove his transcendence and man demonstrate his indispensability to God. We call ourselves human beings. Are we true to the meaning of the word human? In Sanskrit and in Pali, the prefix su, su, and in Avestan, the prefix hu, hu, h and s being interchangeable according to the language used, stands for the good. In Sanskrit and Pali, sugata means having fared well, happily attained the goal. We are told in the dictionary that the root man means to think, believe, imagine, suppose, conjecture. In the Zarathustrian scriptures, hu mata, hu ukta, hu varshta mean good thought, good word, good deed, which is the way to heavenly bliss. So, human could mean good or blissful, thinking or thinker. In Genesis 1:27, we have, so God, in Hebrew Elohim, created man in his own image. Male and female created he them, that is, men and women. I would rather say, created he him and her, because each man and each woman is possessed of both masculine and feminine elements. Since all our thinking is inaudible talking, a ceaseless, silent chatter, mainly centering round ourselves, the words think and thinking are hopelessly inadequate translations for the root man. Does anything we say, audibly or inaudibly, create light, the firmament, the waters or the dry land? I do not care to use the word God where creation is concerned because of the anthropomorphization of that wonderful monosyllable. I prefer the Hebrew word Elohim as in the original because it represents in truth the holistic creative activity by which the primordial, undifferentiated spiritual energy, infinite and eternal, becomes the total reality, part of which is visible and manifested, which is the finite and temporal, and the rest which remains invisible, imperishable, and unmanifested. So, instead of the English translation, now I'll take the two verses together, of Genesis 1, 26 and 27, as they stand to this day in the Bible, I would rather present those verses as follows. And Elohim minded, let us create man in our own living likeness, and let him have dominion. Dominion meaning responsibility as house lord, protector, and healer, and not as an exploiter, dominator, and predator over all the earth. So Elohim created man in the likeness of Elohim. Male and female, each being both masculine and feminine, did Elohim bring forth. I use the word minded instead of said because pure mind is that archetypal form in which the primordial creative energy acts when bringing forth the cosmos. Pure mind, which spells order, is the transcendental source of the Greek nous, of the Sanskrit buddhi. Each of those words, nous and buddhi, means unerring insight into truth embodied in us. In the Trismegistic teachings, the divine Poimander, Greek Poimandros, the shepherd of men, the teacher and ideal archetype of all mankind, teaches Hermes, I am the light, the pure mind, the nous. The word of light is the creative word, the logos, the thought in the mind of God. The thought in the mind of God. Now we can begin to sense very subtly the profound meaning of the Sanskrit root man. In my book, The Heart of Religion, I put it in these terms. Man is transcendence thinking. This thinking has no resemblance to our silent, discursive talking. It is instantaneous creating, creative action in eternity. God's speech is pure, wordless revelation to purified man, to the perfected Holy One. Poimander also declares, all Father mind, being light and life, did bring forth man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love as being his own child, for he was beautiful beyond compare, the spit of his father, and on him did bestow all his formations, that is, his divine powers and qualities. So, human truly means the good creator, and since the good is blissful, you, a human being, are a blissful creator, essentially. Man can go to this divinely fulfilling culmination. You may well say that the overwhelming majority of the 5 billion members of the species Homo sapiens have not quite succeeded in giving evidence of co-equality with their father or of their self-arrogated sapience. That is true. But if you will kindly allow me to hold a brief on behalf of myself and all my fellow human beings, and patiently consider the matter, we may find some light in the darkness. Early in my talk, I said that man is fundamentally a religious being and only very secondarily a political, social, and economic animal. We have noted that each person identifies the self, I, first person singular, with his own psychophysical organism. As an existential being, he is conscious of himself as separate from the rest of the universe, which is the not-self. He knows that the organism is mortal, but usually he is conditioned to believe that there resides in him some spiritual essence, his very own soul or spirit or Atman, which is immortal and that it comes from some eternal creative source named God, Allah or Brahman, etc. He believes this is his true self, and that this imperishable spirit survives the death of the organism as a separate, identifiable entity of a purely spiritual nature or substance. This is where he makes his mistake. John Smith's body is dead and lies mouldering in the grave, but his soul marches on forever. Almost every person in the world finds it impossible to free himself from the concept of a permanently surviving ego, separatively self-conscious eternally. But this can never be the case. You can't split up infinity and eternity into little bits and appropriate one little bit for yourself. It is the whole of transcendence, the whole of infinity, and the all of eternity which is embodied simultaneously into every single particular manifestation. So, he, the organic being living on earth, believes that he, the unique and particular, isolatively self-conscious person, is composed of an immaterial, immortal, divine, and perfect constituent residing in a material, mortal, and imperfect constituent, the living creature you see and know. Each person is actually and positively conscious of his mortal component. This is what he really knows, for it can be seen, heard, touched. Obviously, it exists. To exist, from Latin ex and sistere, means to stand out of. Out of what does the finite and temporal organism stand? It stands out of the postulated but not positively and really known creative source, God or whatever name you give it. Today, we know that the mortal psychophysical body, regarded by itself, is an organic whole. Taking into account the immaterial, immortal constituent, which most people accept on faith, can we say that man is, in fact, a spiritual and organic whole, a human unitary whole, akin to, though not exactly identical with, God, the transcendent unitary whole. I would unequivocally affirm that man is that kind of unitary whole. I affirm this because during the last few millennia, our Mother Earth, ever beautiful, benevolent, and forbearing, has been blessed by the presence of perfected holy ones, such as the founders of the great religions and scores of truly spiritual teachers. What were some of their distinctive characteristics? They were, first and foremost, embodiments of virtue at a transcendental level, virtues such as love, purity, wisdom, truth, goodness, grace, and beauty. They had perfect poise and equanimity. They had unusual healing powers. They were omniscient with regard to the real nature of any person they met, for they had unequaled understanding of human nature. They were profoundly concerned with our true happiness, our well-being and fulfillment. Their consciousness could function in the context of infinity and eternity, as well as in our limited context of finitude and temporality. Their holistic consciousness preeminently distinguished them from ordinary folk who are confined to worldly consciousness. Through many eons, serious-minded people have sought answers to certain questions. How did the world come to be? Who am I? What is the purpose of my existence? What happens after death? Etc., etc. It is insufficiently appreciated that science and psychology, that is to say, the prevalent knowledge, verified or only speculative, of the nature of things and people, have powerfully influenced the ontology and theology of different periods. Since the beginning of the 20th century, science has penetrated into the subatomic world. It has not only shown that some of the age-old laws of the macroscopic world, such as strict causality, do not hold in the subatomic world, but it has also shown that the Cartesian and Newtonian mechanistic worldview, which held sway for three centuries since the days of Descartes, must give way to indeterminacy and probability. The smug certainty of predictability characterizing the mechanistic view has had its quietus. So too has the old idea that the scientist was a purely objective and dispassionate external observer, not affecting the course of his experiment. The scientist is now regarded as a participator in the experiment, which is affected by his consciousness. Einstein, Bohr, de Broglie, Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Sheldrake, and others have topsy-turvied our worldview and made it more and more curiouser and curiouser than our beloved Wonderlander, dear Alice, could ever have done. Most important is the discovery by science that mass and energy, that is, the material and immaterial, are interconvertible. And today, energy has become one of the most significant operative words. This interconvertibility demolishes the age-old rigid barrier between spirit and matter, the subtle and the gross. This breakthrough calls for its appropriate ontology. Since we live in a scientific age and regard the totality as a unitary whole, let us use the word energy to represent all aspects of this whole, the spiritual and immortal, as well as the material and mortal. The word energy will therefore not be restricted to the forms of energy known to science. The primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, the origin or source, is self-existent, infinite, eternal, self-replenishing, inexhaustible, and indestructible, potentially holding within itself all that will be manifested and all that will not be manifested. It is pure consciousness and fundamental substance, immaterial. This is the immortal. Energy, consciousness, substance designates the one origin, just as John Michael Smith, and each name has its distinctive meaning and significance, identifies one single individual. This unitary whole is in vibrant quiescence, vibrant because alive, quiescent because it is in that equilibrium and order which is perfect freedom. A stir of transcendence in eternity is the primal creative act, transcendent karma, which never ceases. Energy differentiates, concretizing through grade after grade of manifestation, till from its subtlest state it reaches its grossest state in matter. Nascent matter constitutes the mortal. Simultaneously, consciousness proliferates, becoming increasingly unknowing till it is blanked in the darkness of complete nascence. This involutionary process is Ochil weaving death, for actual death is complete unconsciousness, downward through the mould. But Ochil's two hands weave simultaneously, for in eternity there is neither a before nor an after. The immortal completely subsumes the mortal. The evolutionary awakening process, liberating the imprisoned consciousness, is but the transformed involutionary process. This is very difficult to visualize or grasp rationally, but is clear to holistic consciousness. In the evolutionary process through plant and animal up to man, there is a developing complexity, sensitivity, and refinement of the organism. The structure of the brain carries all the evidence of the developmental stages, the reptilian, mammalian, and the hominid, which led to the hominids, ourselves. So, the mortal organism carries in it the characteristics of the earlier stages, such as aggressiveness, fear, greed, violence, claim to territory, ritual procedure, and also love and care for family and friends, social hierarchy, and basic emotions derived from attraction and repulsion. The bodily pleasure-pain mechanism, necessary for safety, degenerates into pleasure-lust. It is all this and much more which is the demon host in the psyche, blinding us to the light of transcendence embodied in us, as I said much earlier. You may be surprised that I included love in that list. How many of us know love which is pure and true? Pure love is the unreserved, unconditional, total giving of one's whole self to the beloved without demanding, hoping, or expecting anything for oneself. Love cannot be bartered. Love is the transcendent healer, bliss giver, and comforter, that is, the giver of invincible strength. Start with the love of which you are capable. Watch it, worship it, endure it, and follow it to its divine consummation. Love is its own eternity. The purification of the psyche is indispensable for full awakening to your humanness. The human being is the apparatus for transcendence to realize its own transcendence as a microcosm which will consciously cooperate with transcendence in holistic consciousness towards which man is evolving. This is Orchil weaving life upward through the grass. Never say, all that is so difficult, so utterly beyond me. If you say so, you deny your humanness, your blissful creativeness. In his poem, Adonais, lines 460 to 66, Shelley wrote, "The one remains, the many change and pass. Heaven's light forever shines, earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death tramples it to fragments. Die, if thou wouldst be which thou dost seek. Follow where all is fled. Die if thou wouldst be with that which thou dost seek. That is, die to all worldliness if it is transcendence you seek. Follow where all is fled. That is, enter the empty void, the creative source of plenitude." And lines 478 to 486. That light whose smile kindles the universe, that beauty in which all things work and move, that benediction which the eclipsing curse of birth can quench not, that sustaining love which through the web of being blindly wove by man and beast and earth and air and sea, burns bright or dim, as each are mirrors of the fire for which all thirst, now beams on me, consuming the last clouds of cold mortality. This temporal life and death is the phantom play of life eternal, whose eternal beauty passeth not, though its soul is changed. What is death? It is change so great, so beyond all our sense perception, that our deeply felt longing for endless continuity is extinguished. But that which is beyond our ken, beyond our most penetrating perceptions, is transcendence itself, the deathless immortal. At present, we are incapable of being holistically conscious. So, we weep when the door opens on the way to supreme bliss. We here have forgotten that we are the divine in confinement, and so we are blind to the shining truth. And yet, we humans are the heralds of eternity, for who else on earth but we can sing the song of eternal life through all of ever-dying time? Who else on earth but we can unveil the face of beauty of the infinite as we dance our way through the measureless expanses of space? To this, verily to this, is man going, to the infinity and eternity of transcendence in holistic consciousness, to the love and the wisdom, to the truth and the beauty of transcendence. When will he arrive, you ask? Never in time, but certainly here now, in the immediacy of the living moment. How will he do it, you ask? By living the religious life, which is no other than the whole of the secular life lived virtuously. Beyond, unseizable, wholly beyond, and yet at one with all this, is the truth, silent, still, alone.